what we sang this morning and what we talked about last Sunday can be described as developing a very deep understanding of the law of karma. And from that, we looked at, in some detail, the first of the three pure precepts about cease from evil. And to my mind, it's sort of, and this is just kind of a bringing us up to speed for where I want to jump off from, is that it may be very, very far in the past for a lot of us, but there's this very significant turning point we go through where most of the time we would react to external circumstances in such a way as to say that we were blaming them for how we feel. And with the understanding of the law of karma, we start realizing that actually how we feel is a very internal thing. It has to do with what we've inherited, karmically speaking. It's what we've inherited and what we're continuing to perpetrate, perpetuate by our continuing habits and so on. So it's realizing that it's our past karma that is the cause of our suffering, not external events, not external circumstances. And if you haven't already, just reflect on that at some point, and you'll see what a very deeply significant change that is from how people go about doing things. And Dogen said in what we were singing this morning, he talks about, we free ourselves personally from how we're feeling by recognizing our past evil acts, by recognizing that those karmic tendencies we have. The word contrition, there's recognizing our past evil acts, our past karma, but then there's also contrition, which is basically regretting things that have happened in the past that we've done, and then very wholeheartedly doing our best to not keep doing that. So then at that point, then there's, Dogen talks about how a really important transition takes place. And that is, he says that when we recognize, okay, I've been goofing up, I've been doing things that have been causing suffering, I've inherited things that have been causing suffering. When we realize that and we regret what we've done and want to stop doing that, he says, then we should make an act of deep respect to the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And he even says we should take refuge very quickly in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And in doing that, that's where we find freedom from suffering. We find freedom from suffering and what he calls utter enlightenment. And then he has this very, very important statement where he says, if you accept these precepts wholeheartedly, the highest enlightenment will be yours. So in taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, one of the implications of that is that we take refuge in the precepts. And in taking refuge in the precepts, that's how we find enlightenment. So we need to talk about how this happens, because karma, the law of cause and effect, as I've mentioned in the past, there's, you have volition, you have choice. Whenever you choose to do something, then what that does, it creates karma, it creates an effect. And that's born in feeling. And what's really important to remember is that choice or volition, doing something, that causing results, good or bad, it's important to realize that what's going on here is we're setting up a situation where you make a choice and something comes into being, you know, by what we do. In other words, something is born, something occurs. But anytime something occurs, something will also eventually pass away. So anytime we're using choice, anytime we are doing something, we're basically just simply within this cycle of arising and passing away. And much more broadly, anytime we're dealing at the level of will and volition, choice and so on, we're simply abiding in and working within the world of birth and death. And as we all know, at one level or another, enlightenment is something other than that. What was interesting was that because we had a cat here for some time, I've had occasion to do in the last week, 2 animal funerals. And as some of you may recall, the animal funeral begins with the line, "From the beginning, there is neither birth nor death." Because of the accumulation of karma, you've received the body of an animal. And it says, discard this karmic body quickly and realize the pure mind of Buddhahood. So right there, we're being shown that the realm of choice, the realm of doing, of volition and so on, that's in the realm of karma. That's in the realm of arising and passing away, of life and death, birth and death. As long as we're human, there is no way of avoiding that. But what it's also pointing to is the fact that there's something other than that. There's something other than the arising of the body of an animal. I'm saying that with a slight smile on my face because I'm including myself in that. Two-legged animal. Discard this karmic body quickly and realize the pure mind of Buddhahood. And the way, as it were, we discard this karmic body or put it down, and I think I should say here, sometimes it's just implicit, but to make it more explicit is that when I talk about choice and volition, what we're all aware of is that that's choice and volition based on basically this sense of being a self, of being me, and making choices from that perspective. And what we realize is every time we make choices from that perspective of being me, it just continues that perpetuates that cycle. So the way we discard the karmic body, discard this karmic body quickly, the way we do that is by receiving the precepts. And receiving the precepts, I'm going to read it here shortly, is that Reverend Master Jiyu takes that on, I guess I would say, the deepest level possible. There's the level of receiving the precepts and coming at things from choice and volition and saying, okay, I'm not going to kill, I'm not going to steal, etc. Well, and I should say, in the initial stages, we definitely want to do that. It's nice for us to be aware of the karma, the negative karma we're producing by choice and so on. But it goes much, much deeper than that. And what I wanted to do is read over the second of the 3 pure precepts, which is do only good, and start drawing out of that commentary that Reverend Master Jiyu has, how deeply she's pointing in this one. So she says, the Dharma of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment is the Dharma of all existence. So in other words, the Dharma, the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment is the teaching of all existence. It is the example, it's the teaching that is most vital and helpful for all of us. And then she says, do not do anything unless it is good. And good is in quotes. Do not do anything unless you have first asked the Lord of the house if it is good for you to do it. Okay, so what she's done right here is the Lord of the House was, as far as we know, a phrase that was used by Great Master Kazon. And so Great Master Kazon is, he was what, in the 1300s, as best I remember, in feudal Japan. And using the word lord, you know, very feudal society, so they had feudal lords. And of course, in secular society, the lord was the, basically, you paid attention to what the lord told you what to do. And the lord of the house is referring to the house of your body and mind, of your body, mind, and heart. And so it was a phrase that was in sort of, as it were, direct opposition to or in contradiction to the feudal lord in, you know, medieval Japanese society. So it was, I would imagine it was poking fun at that a bit or being a bit defiant of that, but was also talking about that there is something that's actually much more significant, much more important than sort of the temporal lord, the ruler of the country or the ruler of the territory that you're in. She goes on to say, know that you must take the consequences of what you do if it is not a fully digested act. For you know what lies beyond good and evil, right and wrong. You know that which lies beyond morality. You know the Lord of the House. So right there, she's talking about pointing at the fact that what we talked about the last two Sundays was that basically, you know that you must take the consequences of what you do. You're aware of karmic consequence. You're aware of choice. And if you choose, you know, poorly, you know, non-perceptually, you're going to have to bear that. But what's interesting is that she says, you know, we know what lies beyond good and evil, right and wrong. So good and evil, right and wrong is still dealing with bad karma or good karma. And it's still dealing with, you know, good karma, bad karma. It's still something that comes, arises, something that passes away. It still brings us into the cycle of temporal life. Basically, another way of putting that is that all of this good and evil, right and wrong, it's still, we're still basically left with just ourself in this world. And Reverend Master Jiyu, as we all know, has throughout her lifetime pointed to the fact that there is something beyond just the self, just beyond our own, as it were, kind of isolated individual lives. Ask the Lord of the House at all times before you do anything whatsoever. Is it good? Is it your will? If you do not ask the Lord of the House, you know, here again, she's emphasizing once again, if you do not ask the Lord of the house builder of the house of ego will again pick up his tools. And before you know it, there will be a great structure from which you must again escape. Just another way to emphasize, which Great Master Dogen did on numerous occasions in the Shishogi, they're trying to say every time we choose from our own sort of ego's point of view, self's point of view, we just keep perpetuating this cycle of karma, this cycle of birth and death. If a thing is good, in quotes, in this way it may be done. If it is not good, in quotes, in this way it should not be done. I am not speaking here of good and evil. I am speaking of good in the sense of if it is right. This is beyond right and wrong. If it is good, is beyond good and evil. The words are being used to convey something that through our own practice, through our meditation, we come to sense something other than just our own self perspective, just our own volition, our own choice. And then she emphasizes again that she says this teaching is indeed the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, for there was not one of his acts that was not the result of fully digested perceptual truth. And what's so interesting is she has the phrase of fully digested perceptual truth. She's using that to mean fully digested perceptual truth is when you have asked for and received guidance from the Lord of the house. And then again, it's sort of like that's halfway through the commentary, and she kind of repeats it over again from slightly different perspectives. She says that, let's see, we're jumping here. She says, this is only if you know who the Lord of the house is and do not suffer from the idea that you are the Lord of the house. So again, it's coming at it saying that there is this reality, this sense that you can connect with in your practice, which is clearly something that is other than your own volition, your own choice, your own ego. Please teach me that which it is good for me to do this day. And then she goes on and says, indeed, please give me the certainty that I teach the truth and know indeed that when the still small voice within my mind and heart says yes, I must obey that teaching. When it says no, I must not disobey that teaching. When the Lord of the house speaks, spring up joyfully to answer. Then indeed it is good to do anything whatsoever the Lord of the house asks. Know that the Lord will never break the precepts. So, she puts in another phrase that's equivalent to the Lord of the house. She talks about the still small voice within my mind and heart. I know that for a lot of us in the West, the phrase the Lord of the house is sometimes a little bit difficult. But I would imagine for many of us, the still small voice is something we can identify much more thoroughly with. So what's interesting is that she says at the very beginning to know that the still small voice, if you actually heed the still small voice and follow it, you will never break the precepts. That's good to know too. So you see what's being pointed at here is that we receive the precepts, but what it's doing is actually taking us to a stage where we're beginning to open up to and heed the still small voice, heed the Lord of the house, and using that more and more as a way to guide our lives, to guide our choices. What I wanted to do in the remaining time was try to draw out a bit more through various examples what is being referred to by the Lord of the house or the still small voice. And I want to foremost convey that it's actually a very straightforward, well-known thing for all of us. And it's just a matter, just a matter of allowing that to come forth more and heed that more. So though, for those of you who have been joining our book group meetings on Wednesday afternoons, off and on, we've been reading this wonderful book, to my mind, called Bring Me the Rhinoceros. And it's a series of stories about people in the present, people in the past, working on koans. And remember in the Rules for Meditation, Great Master Dogen says, the koan appears, the koan arises naturally. And to my mind, in reading through this book that we've been looking at, it clearly shows that, you know, there is the formal koan system in Rinzai Zen, But more often than not, the koans that are brought up are actually things that clearly would arise quite naturally for somebody in their daily life. Now remember that Shakyamuni Buddha's, he had the first koan at it, as it were, and the koan was for him, why is there suffering? And for Dogen, the koan is expressed as the most important question for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death completely. That's just as I mentioned in the past, that's a modern reworking of why is there suffering? How do you understand birth and death? The current chapter that we've been looking at in the book called Bring Me the Rhinoceros is talking about it's the late 1700s in Japan, and it's talking about a woman who's an innkeeper, and she does a lot of laundry, she does a lot of washing of dishes, it sounds like she does a lot of cooking, and certainly on occasion interacting with guests and so on, but a very, very, an ordinary daily life. What comes to mind is, you know, when I worked in the guest department at Shasta Abbey, or when I worked in the kitchen, and very familiar with all of the jobs that she's doing. But I wanted to read for you a couple of excerpts from this chapter. There was a line that I read at the end of the commentary by Rev. Master Jiyu, where it says, when the Lord of the house speaks, you know, when the still small voice speaks, spring up joyfully to answer. And she's wanting to convey just the sheer joy that unfolds when we actually start heeding something other than our self, our own ego, and so on. And this chapter is entitled, Are You Afraid of This Happiness? Are you afraid of springing up with joy? I could put it that way. And part of this chapter is really trying to touch on the fact that he's saying that the author is saying that your unhappiness is threaded through your idea of you. Happiness would overturn some things you know about yourself. Happiness asks, are you willing to be a different you? Or are you willing to be not you? So those are just different words, different ways of saying to receive the precepts is to open ourselves up to something other than our own volition, our own choices. And I think these questions from this chapter are also pointing at what I've been talking about at this point. Okay, let's see here. When people need a change of view, sometimes you have to take them far away from their lives and their own plot lines in order to find a moment when they forget who they are. So this whole phrase about forgetting who you are, I think it strikes me as that's a very modern way of putting it, very contemporary way of putting it. And it's really touching on some of the things that, again, receiving the precepts, trying to open up to and hear the still small voice, what they're touching on. Okay, let me see the next quote here. And this is commenting again on the innkeeper. She thought that although she didn't want to go down the road her guests took, a journey was definitely called for. As she went about her work, she listened for a voice, a direction. As we go about our lives, we listen for a voice, we listen for a direction. This is what Great Master Dogen is meaning by what it means very deeply to receive the precepts. this is what the second of the three pure precepts is referring to, which is do only good. It's go about your life, go about your work, listening for a voice, listening for a direction. And if you don't know why you're wanting to listen for a voice or listen for a direction, just go suffer some more. You know, and we're back at it again. You know, it's like, okay, I think I'll receive the precepts again. Now here's an extremely important phrase here. She starts going through a very difficult time in her life at the inn. And there's a local Rinzai Zen teacher by the name of Hakuin close by, and she goes and listens to some of his talks, and she starts the practice that he recommends. And it says, she began meditating a bit, sitting and breathing, or concentrating on washing the endless dishes that made up an innkeeper's life. This meditation didn't seem to be a new direction, but perhaps it was a condition for a new direction. She found a little more space between her thoughts. The trees began to step near again, and she calmed down for a while. But she knew that it was a temporary lull and that her journey, not yet begun, waited inside her. I thought this was a significant thing to say because it's pointing at the fact that our meditation practice is something that we deeply want to keep doing regularly, but it's not the thing that's actually going to be the change that needs to happen. It's a condition for the journey. It's setting the ground. It's you know, setting up the conditions for that. And you know, as we all know, we have to set up the conditions for years and years and years, but it's not the actual thing that's going to happen. Okay, and here's a description of the actual thing that happened. One day, as she was washing a pot, she had a breakthrough. Breaking through into what? Into where? She had washed thousands of pots, but her life was in this one. She was just scrubbing. Actually, when she completely forgot herself, forgot her chapped hands, her wet clothes, and what kind of thoughts she was having. There are dreams so deep that on waking, the dreamer can't at first remember her name or where she is, or even what she is. It was like that for her. The walls, the bowls, and her own hands were utterly strange and new. The moment had no end, and she didn't know which of her worlds was the dream. So she had washed thousands of pots before. And at this particular moment, in washing this particular pot, it says she was just scrubbing. You know, and we're told for working meditation, you know, just sweep. Just carry the firewood, just clean, or with meditation, just sit. She was just scrubbing actually when she completely forgot herself. So there's the dropping away of concern about your own thoughts, your own feelings, your own perspective of being a self scrubbing a pot. And I've often liked talking about, you know, with people to talk about meditation, about, you know, asking them if there are times when they just completely forget themselves in some activity they're doing, you know, where they completely lose track of time and so on. It'd be very interesting to kind of not do it right now, but it'd be interesting to see if we tend to do that more as we get older, or if we tend to do that more often when we're younger. So one of the the things about this chapter that I think is interesting is he's taking the scrubbing a pot and using that as a metaphor for meditation. Using that as a metaphor for what the next step can be in terms of losing the self and allowing this deeper understanding to occur. And one of the things he talks about is that, and I think it applies oftentimes to the way we've understood taking on the precepts. The precepts are being phrased as do not this, do not that. And he talks about, you know, working in a kitchen and so on, there are knives and there are pots, and refraining from is often like using a knife to kind of cut the roots of your habits and behavior. And that seems to only go to a certain point. You know, it's like if I stop doing all of these bad things that I'm doing, all of these habitual things I'm doing, if I stop creating all of this karma, there's this thought that, well, then I'll find enlightenment. And it's actually not the case. The way we find it, which he uses here with the analogy of the pot, he says it could be just as interesting to imagine a koan as a pot or a vessel. In this approach, you would embrace whatever happened as something belonging to the koan. Whatever joy, memory, celebration, or desire happens, into the pot it goes to get cooked and transformed. And I think this is touching more on kind of the deeper aspect of our meditation practice, where in the sense of we're not holding on or pushing away thoughts, emotions, feelings, etc. Another way of looking at that is we're just allowing them to be there. We're embracing them. If you are working with a pot metaphor, you don't have to interfere with your thoughts or feelings. You needn't approve or disapprove of them. This is not the moment of pruning. It's more like the moment of making wine. Compassion has to start somewhere, and embracing your own life is itself the beginning of a change of heart. So there's one last bit here. So this moves to how he finally sums things up. He says, when you are not afraid to forget who you are, life in the kitchen or life in the office might contain huge and overwhelming happiness. Everything you look at, the door, the walls meeting in the corner of the room, the light shining on the cell phone, might be so alive that it looks back. Other people might not be who you thought they were. Family members might be as fresh and surprising as strangers. And you, whom you have only apparently known all your life, might be fresh and surprising to yourself too. So in terms of the phrasing of the Lord of the house, the still small voice, we hear the still small voice whenever we are simply giving ourselves to just doing what's in front of us. When, as he says here, when we completely forget ourselves, we completely forget ourselves by just the task at hand. What was interesting was that, as an illustration, I was, you know, many of you who've been here to the Priory know where the office is, and it's got two really nice corner windows. And I was working there only a few days ago, had one of the windows open, and I heard this very, very, very soft meowing coming from outside. And oftentimes Zoe, you know, she'll be outside and she'll just meow as kind of a way of saying hello. She'll meow as a way of saying, please come to the door and let me in, although she has a cat door. So I heard this incredibly faint, gentle meowing, And what went through my mind was, she's stuck in the car. And it was a very faint thing that went through my head. It was a very soft thing that went through my head. And what I did was very clearly, I was like, without even noticing it in a way, I said, oh no, that couldn't be possible. So I got up from the office desk and went to the front porch and looked around, looked out. Nope, didn't see Zoe. Then I went to the back door, looked out the back door. Nope, she wasn't there either. I went back to the office and I heard it really, really softly again. And then I actually sort of said in a louder voice, you know, I said, hi, Zoe. Then I heard it again. And so I went out to where the car was, which was not too far away. And sure enough, she was stuck in the car. I had, you know, because the sun kind of comes down, beats down on the side driveway in the middle of the day quite a bit, I'd opened the all four of the car windows slightly. And they were only open about three inches, but she managed to sneak in to the car.
And then couldn't get back out.
And then couldn't get back out again.
Flattened down pretty good. It's good thing it was under.
But I think it's a really good illustration of what's meant by the still small voice. The first aspect about it is that over and over again, it always comes up as something that I wouldn't have thought of. It wouldn't have come to my mind. You know, once it came up, you know, as I clearly mentioned, it's like, no, she couldn't be stuck in the car. How could she possibly have gotten through the window? It was very, very narrow. And it took me quite a bit of, you know, it was still niggling at me though. It's like, oh, maybe I better check in on this, because there was a sense of, I don't know, sort of dis-ease with me, or something wasn't quite right. You know, and it took me about 5 minutes or so to finally, oh yeah, there she is in the car. But I wanted to use that just as one illustration of, that's a very mundane thing. It was actually a very good thing to have had come up. She would have gotten pretty warm, I think, eventually. But I think for me, it kind of illustrates again my ongoing relationship with the still small voice. Mm-hmm. To this day, I still can so easily override it, mm-hmm, with my own perspective or my own thoughts. But the thing, the conditions were that I was just really quietly carrying on with office work, just doing what needed to be done. And this extra thing came to mind. So in saying that, I mean, there are many, many other things that come to mind as examples. And I would hope that for many of you, all of you, there are situations that come up like that also. And it's really a matter of cultivating a way of going about our day where we are sort of internally quiet and still enough that we give room for, we give space for that voice, that intimation, that sense to arise in us. As another quick example, I think that, I mean, I've officially been the prior since middle of June, but I think that with Reverend Oriana and Zoe officially leaving just a few days ago, it now feels like, okay, yeah, now it's really stepping into the role. And, you know, as you all know, there are just many, many things to be done here, many things to be tended to. And I try to go about just being very open, and things just unfold in various ways. I'll get a sense of, oh, okay, now it's time to go do this. Those of you who aren't here in person, you can you probably get a sense of where the camera is right now that you're looking, you know, that you're seeing the picture from. But yesterday afternoon, it's like, okay, we need to figure out how the office computer works. I had to take out 4 or 5 wires hooked between it and the monitor, and then I brought it all out to the common room here and then set it up again. We're seeing how this works. It was quite an adventure. Well, I think I will end it at that. And in a way, it's just sort of a bringing us to the stage of saying that it's the still small voice, or whatever word or phrase you want to use, that is really what Reverend Master Jiyu has transmitted to all of us, what's really at the heart of our practice. And at this point now, since it's out on the table, it's something that now and in the future, it would be delightful to just talk more about, offer each other examples of it, what we've done to try to cultivate it, allow it to come forth more. So if there's anything anyone would like to bring up more,